More hard slaps, more punches, more cruel pinches. He tries to swallow, but he can't, so he hangs his head and lets the acid drool from his mouth into his lap. When he raises his head, he thinks their house is on fire, and he is bewildered as to the cause of this disaster. Then he realizes that he's a grown man who has put the things of childhood far behind him. He is sitting in a vehicle, his wrists zip-tied to the steering wheel, and the truth of time and place returns to him. He turns his head to his left. She's standing a few feet from the missing window, her face reflecting the firelight from the south slope. That perfect face, radiant like the face of a goddess, one eye brown, the other blue. His speech is thick at first.
Your eyes are two colors. You lost a contact. I know which is true. Blue is true. Jane Hawk's eyes are blue.
And you're Ivan Petro.
You took my wallet.
She tosses the wallet through the open window. It strikes his face and falls into the stomach acid on his pants. The air smells of smoke. There's a haze of it in the rover. Leaf fires and weed fires burn low throughout the glen. Where did you first make me? She asks. Because his mind isn't yet as clear as it needs to be, he says,
Placerville. You came out of some market with a deli bag.
Where is it? She asks.
Placerville? You know where it is. You've been there.
Don't jerk me around. Time's running out. Where did you plant the transponder? He shouldn't have mentioned Placerville.
You were sleeping, so I put it up your pretty ass.
She raises a pistol, a heckler, and points it at his face. He smiles scornfully.
You think I buy that crap about how you're a cold-blooded killer? Spare me your evil eye.
I'll kill 100 of you to save my boy.
He's dead already. They filmed it for you. Slit his belly open and let him scream to death.
She only stares at Ivan. One blue, one brown, plus the round black eye of the gun muzzle. A bead of sweat passes between his eyes and down his nose. She lowers the pistol. You're parked in dead leaves. Fire under the gas tank soon. Maybe it'll do the job for me. The engine isn't running. She switched it off. Ivan can drive with his hands bound to the steering wheel, but even if she didn't take the electronic key, he can't reach the push-button ignition or the emergency brake release. His pistol is still on the passenger seat, where he dropped it. He wheezes, as if the smoke has gathered in his lungs. He fakes a coughing fit while he strains to strip the teeth of the zip tie on his right wrist, which is cinched low on the steering wheel, not in her line of sight. It's a ratchet latch. Straining against it draws it tighter. It can't be loosened once snug. It can only be cut. He coughs and strains nonetheless, because his wrists are as thick as ankles, and he is 275 pounds of hard-trained muscle and bone, and his hatred for this bitch is more intense than ever it was for his father. No power on earth is greater than hatred, for it can destroy nations and fuel genocides in which millions die. He is empowered by hatred so virulent and implacable that no binding can restrain him. She moves back a step or two. The transponder. Quick now, or I'll go search for it myself, leave you to burn. He can't pretend to be racked by coughing forever. Continuing to strain against the zip tie, he buys time by telling her what she wants to know.
The kid hasn't been killed. Not even been found yet.
Then maybe you have a chance.
Transponder's attached with epoxy. Can't remove it.
If you want to live, tell me true.
True. You've got to hammer. Hammer it apart.
The white, hot pain in his right hand now exceeds that in his left, the plastic tie cutting into his flesh, his fingers slick with blood. But he thrives on pain, eats it, and is nourished by it. He has grown from child to man on a diet of pain.
It's in the back wheel well, passenger side.
Who have you told about my explorer? The license number?
No one. Those bastard poachers would take you, take all the credit, and keep me down.
He can smell his hot blood dripping from his hand. A blackness pulses around the perimeter of his vision. The pain is so terrible that it brings into his throat another flood of bitter acid, which he swallows hard to repress. What's wrong with you? She wonders.
You twisted, crazy bitch! You! You're what's wrong with me!
You're sweating more than it's hot.
Makes me sweat bullets, telling me I'll be left to burn.
You're doing something there. Having backed away, she approaches again. What are you doing? He chokes on another rush of acid, and it foams from his nose, and his breath stinks as if it is the exhalation of a corpse. Chapter 35. Sitting behind the steering wheel, Ivan Petro reminded Jane of a realistically detailed special effects mannequin, like those that had sometimes been used in old horror movies made before computer animation became ever better and cheaper, when the script called for the head to explode. The cords of muscle in his neck were as taut as winch cables. His skull almost seemed to inflate, flushed face swollen and streaming sweat, nostrils flared, eyes protuberant, the arterioles in his temples prominent and throbbing. Yellowish foam suddenly gushed from his nostrils, and he let out a cry that seemed to be an expression equally of rage and despair, and following that cry came a stream of vicious obscenities and a spray of foul spittle, as if he meant to kill her with the intensity of his hatred. When she stepped close to the broken-out window in the driver's door, she saw his right hand against the steering wheel, like the carved stone fist of some wrathful god who could cleave the planet with a single blow, the zip tie embedded in the flesh of his wrist, blood oozing as black as tar in the half-light, his shirt sleeve saturated to the elbow. That band of hard, binding plastic was a quarter of an inch thick, and the angled teeth of the one-way ratcheted clasp was a marvel of design. The zip tie had proved far more reliable than handcuffs. She had never known anyone to be able to free himself after being properly manacled. It simply wasn't possible. Ivan Petro surely realized the futility of this struggle, yet his fury escalated, his hatred intensified, his effort increased, as though this brief imprisonment had driven him into raving madness, so that he'd strive to break free until a cerebral artery ruptured and death flooded through his brain. The zip tie snapped. His sledgehammer fist flew from the steering wheel, braceleted in bloody plastic, a volley of blood drops spattering the dashboard, the windshield, even as the damaged hand dropped toward the pistol on the passenger seat. Cut muscle, sprained tendons, injured nerves didn't affect him. As if some mystical entity had taken possession of him, some dark spirit not constrained by the laws of nature. Jane said, "No," and he said,
"Yes."
And she shot him twice in the neck as his hand came off the passenger seat with the pistol. Stunned, Jane backed away a few steps, feeling as if she had crossed from the waking world into a manic dream without the need to fall asleep. If he'd snapped the zip tie, then maybe anything could happen. Maybe the ravaged flesh of his bullet-torn throat could mend before her eyes, and the bullets whistle backward through the smoky air and into the barrel of her heckler, and return to the magazine, as if they had never been fired. Ivan Petro remained slumped in the driver's seat, however, and the dreamlike horror began to relent, until, as fire flared through the leaves around the Rover, she recognized something chilling about the angle of the dead man's head. It was tipped slightly forward and toward his right shoulder. The posture of Petro, behind the wheel of the Rover, was similar to that of her Nick when she had found him sitting in the bathtub, dead by his own hand. No, not just similar. The same. The angle of the head, the bloody throat. For a day after her beautiful Nick removed himself from this world, she had been in a state of shock. Before her muddled thinking cleared, before she grew certain he hadn't been capable of suicide under any circumstances. Those first 24 hours were like a century in purgatory. In confusion and grief, she searched her heart for what guilt might be hers. What might she have done to turn him away from self-destruction? What could she have been for him that she had not been? Why hadn't she recognized his precarious state of mind? She had known him too well, however, to accept for long that he had taken his own life. They were not just lovers, not just husband and wife, not just creators of their lovely boy. Their souls were so precisely configured to fit together that she and Nick were a two-piece puzzle, a puzzle solved when they took their marriage vows, the meaning of life made pellucid to them when they became as one. Now, the angle of Ivan Petro's head and his gruesome throat wound put her back in Virginia on that terrible evening just days before Thanksgiving. For a moment, the world seemed so strange that she couldn't hope ever to make her way through it to a place of peace. But only for a moment. Part of Nick remained alive, their boy, and she could not fail Travis. To fail him would also be to fail Nick for real this time. "Screw that," she said. She turned her back on Ivan Petro and sprinted across the glen, up the north slope, where thin strata of pale smoke moved west to east, layered ghosts swimming toward a different haunt. Shadow-robed trees loomed in solemn threat, like the unforgiving judges in some final court. As she ascended, her eyes stung and her nostrils burned and her chest ached. When she drew near the crest, concussion waves trembled through her from the explosion of the Range Rover's fuel tank, but she did not look back. She broke from the trees into the field of weeds and ribbon grass, greedily inhaling clean air, blowing out the smell of smoke. Passing the hammer that she had thrown at Petro, she plucked it off the ground. At the Explorer, she snatched up the screwdriver and the pieces of the shattered burner phone, threw everything onto the passenger seat. When she went around to the driver's door, she saw a dark and churning column just now emerging through the treetops in the glen, a few tendrils of lighter smoke rising elsewhere. She drove around the perimeter of the parking lot toward the exit lane. It seemed that people at the truck stop had become aware of the fire in the woodlet only after the explosion, and the sudden greater rush of smoke that followed it. As far as she could tell, no one associated her with those events. Out of the truck stop, quick onto Interstate 5, southbound. Sirens in the distance. The wailing rose higher, but then faded, and she never saw the sources or was able to deduce from where they came. Fewer than 10 minutes had passed in the glen. She was an hour north of Los Angeles, early enough to beat the rush hour traffic that would clog every artery in and out of the city. She thought of the dead man in the woods. The shakes took her. Others might have hoped for good luck tomorrow in Indio and later in Borrego Valley, but in times as troubled as these, she placed no hope in the cruel gods of fortune. She trusted only in her own preparations and actions, in the power of love to inspire her to do the wisest thing to the best of her ability. She pulled into a rest stop before the Tejon Pass, waited until she had the place to herself, located the transponder in the wheel well of her Explorer, and used her hammer to render it inoperative. The backplate of the device couldn't be loosened from the epoxy that fixed it to the car, but when she examined the fragments that fell to the pavement, she was confident that the SUV was not trackable. Once more racing south on I-5, she wanted music, a song written out of profound love. She chose pianist David Benoit playing Kay's song, which he'd written for his wife. She turned up the volume. Piano chords and notes are known not only to her ears, but also are felt in her fingertips, weave through her heart, nourish her soul, as milk makes strong the bones. Chapter 36. The grieving boy, who'd taken most of the night to fall asleep, still slept and slept. The dogs needed to be toileted and fed, But leaving the boy alone seemed wrong. Cornell ought to do something. What? To be prepared for when the mother came to collect her child. Like Mr. Paul Simon had sung, the mother and child reunion is only a motion away. This was more responsibility than Cornell usually shouldered. When he tried to sit near the boy and read, he couldn't concentrate on the prose. He worried that he was going to do something, or fail to do something, that would endanger Travis. Now he stood over the lazy boy recliner again, watching the child. Travis breathed so softly. Maybe he wasn't breathing at all. Cornell wanted to touch him, see if he was alive, but dared not. All night, the German shepherds had patrolled the library, taking turns sleeping, sniffing Cornell, trying to induce him to pet them, which he couldn't do, because it might be like touching a person. Any place where another person touched him was a wound that didn't bleed blood, that bled the very essence of him, his mind and soul. By a touch, another person could drain Cornell out of himself and leave his body a mindless husk. This was a false fear related to his personality disorder, but knowing it was a false fear didn't make him less fearful. Strange. Otherwise, he respected reason. But this streak of unreason was baked into him like a vein of cinnamon in a morning roll, though cinnamon was a good thing and unreason was not good. The dogs were agitated. They needed to potty. Cornell didn't want the dogs to potty on his Persian carpets. If he tried to put the dogs' leashes on their collars, they might touch him. No good. No good. No good. The dogs might be trained not to run away, but what if they did? The boy loved them. He'd be devastated if the dogs ran away. Here was what responsibility meant. It meant making decisions that affected someone other than Cornell himself. When the dogs started whining, he said, "All right, I'll take you out. But don't run away from me, please and thank you." Outside, the day was warm and bright, with none of the soft colors of the library lamplight that he loved so much. The dogs ran a few yards from the door before they peed. Then they sniffed around for a minute, and finally both squatted to poop. Cornell was embarrassed, watching the dogs' toilet, but he was also fascinated, because they seemed self-conscious, glancing at him sheepishly, maybe because he hadn't watched them do this before. When they had pooped, they stood staring at him expectantly, ears pricked forward. After a minute of confusion, he realized they expected him to pick up the poop in plastic bags, like people did. He didn't have plastic bags. Besides, except for the graveled area around the blue house, in which cacti and succulents were the only landscaping, the rest of this acreage, including that in the vicinity of the barn, was a mess of dead grass, sage, long-stemmed buckwheat, assorted weeds, and bare earth. Leaving poop wasn't as offensive as it would have been on a golf course or a church lawn. As Cornell moved toward the house, his hulking freak show shadow preceding him, the dogs watched. When he called them, they glanced at the poop and regarded him with puzzlement, maybe wondering why he was so poorly trained, but at last they came to the house with him. The large bag of kibble stood in the kitchen where the boy had said it would be. His suitcase of spare clothes and other items was in the smaller of the two bedrooms. After locking the door, Cornell returned to the barn, carrying the kibble in one hand and the suitcase in the other.
"Come along, please and thank you," he said to the dogs.
And it delighted him that they trotted at his side, one to his left, one to his right, as if they cared for him the way they cared for the boy. The electronic key in his pants pocket automatically unlocked what appeared to be a flimsy, man-sized barn door that was, in fact, steel behind its rotten plank facade. He and the dog stepped into a white vestibule. He closed the door behind him. After a few seconds, its lock engaged with a hard clack. The electronic lock on the door before him responded to his hand on the knob and unlocked itself so he could push through into the library. To the left of the door through which Cornell entered, another door led to the bathroom. To the right lay the part of the fourth wall that wasn't lined with books, but instead featured a kitchen counter, cabinets, a double sink, two large sub-zero refrigerators, two microwaves, and an oven. The boy stood peering in one of the sub-zeros. The dogs whined with pleasure and hurried to the boy. Travis turned to Cornell.
Mr. Jasperson, can I ask something?
Can you? Yes, of course. And call me Cornell.
What runs the refrigerators?
Cornell blinked at him. He put down the kibble and suitcase.
Runs? Well, the power company.
What happens after the world ends?
The world won't end, just civilization.
When the boy frowned, Cornell explained,
just cities and stuff, not the planet, not the planet, not the planet.
So what runs the refrigerators then?
A generator, a big tank of propane buried out there. It'll run library and bunker 14 months, or just the bunker for 30.
What then? The boy asked.
Maybe a new civilization will start up.
What if nothing starts?
Then I'll probably be dead.
Probably, Travis agreed. I thought you never go into town.
I don't ever go to town anymore. Hardly ever did, even when I lived in the little blue house. I don't want to scare people.
So where do you get chocolate milk and stuff if you never go into town?
Gavin comes down here once every month like clockwork. He stocks the refrigerators.
Maybe he will. If he's not.
If he's not dead, if he's not dead, if he's not dead.
The boy closed the refrigerator and regarded Cornell solemnly, as did the dogs.
Mr. Jasperson, why do you say things three times?
You can call me Cornell. I don't say everything three times.
But you say some things three times.
Things I don't want to happen or wish weren't true. Or sometimes things I think aren't true but wish they were.
Does that work?
No, but I feel a little better. Do you want something to eat?
I'm kind of hungry.
I can make eggs, scrambled or fried, cheese or not, or eggs all other ways, with toast. I can make bologna sandwiches, mustard or mayonnaise, or both. I can make many kinds of meals.
Are you hungry? The boy asked.
I am. I'm hungry.
Then I'll have what you're having, the boy said.
The dogs padded to the bag of kibble, sniffing with excitement.
I should feed the dogs.
Cornell bent to the bag.
They're nice dogs, so far. They don't bite, so far. Not so far.
They like you a lot, Travis said.
Cornell froze. Hunched over the bag, he turned his head to stare at the boy.
How do you know?
Can't you see? They like you.
I don't see. I don't know how to see that.
Well, they do. They like you.
Cornell looked at one dog, at the other. They wagged their tails.
Maybe it's just because I have the food.
No, they really like you.
Around other people, Cornell always felt too big and awkward and strange, even around his cousin Gavin, and he felt no less so around animals. Before this, dogs barked at him. Cats hissed, bared their teeth, and fled.
Maybe. Maybe not. But that would be something. That would be something. That sure would be something.
Chapter 37. If he believed they were real, Egon Gottfried would hate Texans. And if he believed Texas was a real place rather than a concept, he would never go there again. Chase and Alexis Longren, with their three daughters, Lori, Daphne, and Artemis, are being temporarily detained in the living room. When Chris Roberts and Janice Dern attempt to interrogate the family, all five detainees act as though they are gathered here by their own choice. They pretend to be unaware of any intruders and speak only to one another, mostly about television shows they have seen recently. They are certain that Godfrey and his crew aren't legitimate authorities, or at least that they aren't loyal to either the Bureau or the country. Clearly, through her in-laws, Jane Hawke has poisoned the minds of these people. Egon Godfrey observes this impudence until it bores him. Then he goes to the fenced exercise yard at Stable 5, where Pedro and Alejandro have corralled all the employees, 8 men and 2 women. 9 of those 10 are day workers and can claim not to have been on the property at 2 a.m., when Ansel and Claire Hawke arrived on horseback, and perhaps soon thereafter left by a more comfortable form of transportation. Only one of them, Bodie Houston, a lean-muscled, sun-seared 30-something guy with jet-black hair, has been here all night in a small ranch manager's house. He claims to so admire the FBI, its history and its high standards and its incorruptible agents, that he bitterly regrets having slept too soundly to have seen anything. Bitterly regrets it.
As a kid, see, all I ever did want to be was FBI. What an honor if I could help you fellas. Damn, but don't I feel as useless as a fifth leg on a horse?
Godfrey regards him in silence after that speech, trying to decide whether the unknown playwright wants him to handcuff Bodie Houston, drive him to a remote location, and throw him off a cliff, or walk away. He chooses to walk away. Chapter 38. Cornell's Library for the End of the World. Windowless. Quiet. A fortress of books. In one of the reading areas, 4 mismatched but beautiful armchairs faced one another in a circle. Between the chairs were antique tables, each of a different period. Stained glass lamps on the tables, the colored light so soft and pretty. Chairs and everything standing on a late 19th century Tabriz carpet in shades of red and gold. Cornell had tried to make the library match his idea of what heaven would be like. Except he hoped that he wouldn't be alone in heaven, and that he wouldn't look scary to people there, and that he would know what to say to the other people he met. Now, he had company, and it seemed like this was a test to see if he might be ready for an afterlife in which he wouldn't be alone. The 2 big dogs were lying on the carpet, each with its tail tucked between its legs, one of them snoring. Cornell had quickly grown more comfortable with the dogs than he'd thought possible on first encountering them. For one thing, there was no need to carry on a conversation with the dogs. Cornell sat in a wingback chair. The boy was lost in a big club chair. By contrast with the child, Cornell felt like a pterodactyl folded onto a perch meant for a sparrow. Feet on footstools, they faced each other from the north and south points of the reading circle. The dining trays were hooked over their chair arms.
"Sandwiches are real good," the boy said.
Cornell wasn't sure what to say, though it seemed safe just to describe the sandwich.
"Buttered bread, 2 slices of bologna, 2 slices of cheese, 1 Velveeta and 1 provolone, sliced tomatoes, a little mayonnaise, put in a sandwich press and toasted."
That seemed to go over well, so he added,
"2 sweet pickles on the side, and a little bag of potato chips for each of us."
"The cola is good with the sandwiches," the boy said.
Having read everything on the soda can, having an eidetic memory, Cornell decided not to list the contents of the beverage, but he did quote a fact he found interesting.
"Canned under the authority of the Coca-Cola Company, Atlanta, Georgia, 30313. By a member of the Coca-Cola Bottlers Association, Atlanta, Georgia, 30327.
The boy said,
"I've never been to Atlanta."
"Neither have I," said Cornell.
"We should go someday."
"No, that's a scary idea."
"Scary why?"
"Too far, too big," Cornell said.
"I guess it is if you say so."
This conversation thing with a new person was easier for Cornell than it had often been before. After a silence, the boy said,
"Your Uncle Gavin's cousin."
"My mother, Shamira, was his mother's sister. But the family disowned her, and she disowned them when she was 16, before I was born. The family never knew about me."
"How do you disown somebody?"
"You push them out, close the door, and never see them again."
"Wow. That's mean. Why'd they do that?"
"My mother was a terrible, angry drug addict and a prostitute."
"What's a prostitute?"
"She sold sex." "Oh, you didn't hear that. You didn't hear it. You didn't hear. She made love for money."
This conversation thing had broken Cornell into a sweat. The boy said,
"Making love is making babies. She made babies?"
"Just me. I was a baby once."
"So who's your dad?"
"Nobody knows. It's a big mystery."
"Doesn't your mom remember? You should ask her."
"My mother died when I was 18.
The boy put down his sandwich.
"That's really sad."
"It was a long time ago. Go ahead and eat. See? I'm eating. She died of a drug overdose. She couldn't help herself. We have to eat. We can't help ourselves."
The boy sat looking at his sandwich. Then he said, "It isn't right, people having to die."
"No. No. It isn't. It isn't right. It isn't right. But that's the way it is. And we have to eat."
"So, if the family never knew about you, how does Uncle Gavin know?"
"When I got rich, I hired a detective to find my family and tell me about them. Gavin was the one I thought I might like, and I do. I like him, or liked him. He's the only one I let know about me. Which is why maybe you're still safe here. You're still safe here. You're safe here."
"I sort of feel safe."
"That's good. That's nice. Now, eat your sandwich, please and thank you."
The boy took a bite of the sandwich and chewed thoughtfully and swallowed and said,
"How rich are you?"
"About 300 million.
"Wow. I can't count that high."
"It's scary,"
Cornell said. Thinking about all that money was so frightening that he almost put down his sandwich, but he needed to be a positive role model for the boy, so he continued eating.
"How'd you make all that money?"
"I invented several very popular apps."
"I heard of apps, but I don't know any."
"You will one day. Anyway, by the time I was 24, I made so much money it scared the bejesus out of me."
"Why would money scare you?"
"I started out with $10. 4 years later, after taxes, I had 300 million. That can't happen unless a civilization, unless all of this, the way we live, is a mouse of cards."
"A what?"
"I apologize, please and thank you. Sometimes the wrong word comes out of me. House. Our civilization must be a house of cards. So I decided to get ready for Apocageddon."
"And so you built this secret library?"
"And the even more secret bunker. Do you think I'm crazy?"
"No, you aren't crazy. You're real smart."
Pleased by the boy's praise, Cornell said,
"I wouldn't have been able to do it and keep it secret without all the Filipino workers who couldn't speak a word of English."
Chapter 39. beginning to wonder if the script calls for him to be stymied by a bunch of mule-headed Texas horse traders. Egon Gottfried checks in with Rupert Baldwin, who is busy in Chase Longren's office in Stable 3. Rupert has gone through the contents of the desk and the filing cabinet without finding anything of interest, and he has scattered those papers on the floor, perhaps as payback for Chase's comment about the Bureau's dress code. Rupert considers himself a sartorial rebel. He is fond of his corduroy suits and bolo ties. Using Longren's computer, he has backdoored the DMV to search state records for vehicles registered to the Longrens or to Longren stables. Pickup trucks, horse vans, two SUVs, a Ford sedan. Rupert says,
I gave the list to Vince. He's checking to see if there's a set of wheels that should be here but isn't.
The unknown playwright is in a mood for dramatic efficiency because even as Rupert finishes speaking, Vince Penn bursts into the room like the burly star of a former circus act featuring a bear.
All the vehicles are here except for the Mercury Mountaineer. I checked the garage, all the stables, the hay barn. I went into the house and checked under the beds, but it's nowhere.
He looks from Gottfried to Rupert Baldwin, to Gottfried again.
That last part about the bed, see, that was just a joke.
In the interest of moving things along, Egon Gottfried doesn't get into a conversation with Vince. On learning that the Mountaineer is their search target, Rupert uses his DMV registration to consult a cross-referenced National Security Agency directory that contains the unique GPS transponder code of every vehicle in the country. He obtains the one by which this particular Mountaineer can be tracked by satellite. Godfrey watches as a map appears on the screen and a blinking red indicator signifies the location of the vehicle.
It's not moving. Maybe parked, says Rupert.
Parked where?
Downtown Killeen, Texas.
How far from here is that?
Not far, says Vince Penn. I was in Killeen for a few weeks once. Met this girl there. She wasn't beautiful or nothing, but she was pretty enough so I thought I might marry her. Then it turned out she was a whore, and it wasn't marriage she wanted.
Somewhat more helpful than Vince, Rupert says,
It looks like about 130-some miles. Nearest helicopter we could use is in Austin. By the time it came here and picked us up and flew us to Killeen, it'd be quicker by car. We have to drive through Austin, which will slow us down, but we can still make it to Killeen in 2 hours, maybe 2 hours 15.
Chapter 40. Cornell Jasperson kept thinking that something very bad was about to happen. He and the boy were getting along so well, and the dogs had not attacked him. Nevertheless, every now and then Cornell stiffened and lifted his head and listened intently, in expectation of a sudden threat. Not the collapse of civilization, not yet, but something not good. For dessert, they enjoyed pineapple coconut muffins, which they tore apart and ate with their fingers, still sitting in the circle of lamplit chairs.
While I lived over there in the little blue house, I did all the construction drawings myself.
You said Filipino workers. What are they?
The boy wondered.
Filipino. From the Republic of the Philippines. Half a world away. 7,000 islands, though most people live on 11.
Gee, couldn't you find workers closer than half a world?
Not highly skilled construction workers who spoke only Tagalog and couldn't tell anyone in Borrego Valley that they were building a secret library and bunker, please and thank you.
Tagalog is a funny word.
It sort of is.
A crawly feeling quivered down the nape of Cornell's neck, between his misshapen shoulder blades, along his spine. For no good reason, he looked at the ceiling in expectation of something.
What's wrong? The boy asked.
Nothing. Anyway, by the time I made 300 million, I also made a lot of connections with powerful people. I located the workers, got them visas and green cards,
brought them from the Philippines. They were nice. They worked hard. Sometimes they sang at night. Their singing was very pretty.
What did they sing?
Mostly about Malaysian legends and the sea and the stars and Buddha and Jesus. Sometimes Elvis Costello in Tagalog.
Cornell sang a few lines in Tagalog, amazed to be so relaxed. He sang without feeling silly. He looked at the boy when they were talking, though he didn't usually look so directly at other people.
These muffins are really good, the boy said.
Cornell licked sweet icing from his fingers.
Very kind of you to say so.
How do you talk to the Philippines without them knowing English?
Before I hired them, I learned Tagalog. They lived in trailers on the property and never went into town. And by the time they flew back home, I'd made millionaires of them all.
That's humongous. 12 millionaires.
It cost a lot more than that. Counting materials and all the donations, it cost an arm and an egg.
You mean leg?
Leg. I don't know why that happens, that word thing. Anyway, it cost a farm and a leg. Oh, there, it happened again.
The boy laughed. So did Cornell. Though a moment later he was frowning at the cluster of 4 security monitors that hung from the ceiling. When a warm-blooded moving creature larger than a coyote drew within 10 feet of the building, a soft alarm would sound, and an image of the visitor would appear on each screen. From any point in the library, he could see what was happening outside. The screens were blank.
Donations to what?
The boy asked.
To, like, wounded warriors? Uncle Gavin and Aunt Jessie give to them, and others like them.
These were donations to some officials, to let us have a high construction fence, to build without getting plans approved, without inspections. A secret bunker isn't much good if it's not secret.
You mean payoffs, bribes.
How does a 5-year-old boy know payoffs and bribes?
I'm going on 6. And anyway, my mom's FBI. I'm an FBI kid.
Yes, of course. An FBI kid.
These are the best muffins ever, the boy said.
I got the recipe from one of the construction workers. They grow a lot of pineapples and coconuts in the Philippines. Would you like me to get you another muffin?
Sure, you bet. That would be great, please and thank you.
When Cornell lifted his tray and scooted forward in the chair and put the tray on the footstool, the 2 dogs raised their heads to consider the unfinished muffin.
Nothing of that belongs to you,
Cornell said. The good dogs lowered their heads, and he regretted having spoken sharply. At the kitchenette, as he took a muffin from a Tupperware container and put it on a small plate, he glanced at the security monitors a couple times, though no alarm had sounded. He supposed that he was just Cornell being Cornell, too smart for his own good, as his mother had often said, plagued by a weird developmental disability, afraid civilization was going to collapse, but even more afraid that someone might touch him and drain the soul out of his body. He was maybe a little too obsessed with death. As Mr. Paul Simon had sung, "We come and we go, that's a thing I keep in the back of my head." Chapter 41. Egon Gottfried leaves 6 of his people to keep the Longren family and their employees in custody at gunpoint until they hear from him. The detainees must not be allowed to place an unsupervised phone call during that time, which would surely be a call to Ansel and Claire Hawke to warn them that they have been traced to Killeen. Rupert Baldwin and Vince Penn will accompany Gottfried. As they climb into their Jeep Wrangler and as he approaches his Rhino GX, Janice Dern, who followed him from the house, calls out,
"Hey, Egon,
Can I have a minute?
Janice is a dedicated revolutionary and an effective agent, but she seems too tightly wound, as if one of these days an escalating series of dire sounds, gears stripped, springs sprung, flywheels fractured, will arise within her, culminating in a glittering, smoking ejectamenta of clockwork fragments bursting from her ears, nostrils, mouth, and other orifices. She stands too close to Egon, as though she has no concept of personal space, and she makes insistent eye contact, as she always does.
You've got to leave me the ampules and a hypodermic needle and everything else I need to inject a control mechanism.
Inject who?
Lori Longren.
One of the children?
See, then we'll have someone in the family to report to us.
The brain has to reach a certain stage of development before the implant can assemble and function properly. 16. You know we only inject after the 16th birthday.
Oh, please, that's such a steaming pile of horse shit. Just theory.
It's fact, Egon says, though in truth, like so much else, this is only what the unknown playwright wants them to believe. As Paloma Sutherland moves the customized Cadillac Escalade that blocks the driveway, and as Sally Jones waves them through, Rupert and Vince leave in the Jeep Wrangler.
Only after their 16th birthday, Godfrey repeats.
Janice Dern draws a deep breath, blows it out in exasperation.
They didn't try enough kids to be sure the problem is universal.
9, Egon says. Every one had a psychological crack-up within 3 months. Physical collapse, too. Had to be terminated.
9 is too damn small a sample to prove anything. It's worth a try with Lori. This family can lead us to Jane Hawk. If the brat goes batshit crazy and bleeds from the eyes, so what? Why do you care?
I don't. I'm along for the ride. I just do what he wants. She frowns.
He who?
The unknown. Egon looks away from her yellowish-brown flypaper eyes, but they remain stuck to him as he reconsiders his reply.
My Arcadian operator. You answer to me, I answer to him.
So ask him for permission to inject Lori Longren. The worst he can do is say no.
He meets her stare again.
We're wasting time here. I need to get to Killeen.
Janice Dern is quite attractive if you don't look into her eyes for too long. They are eyes less suited to a woman of her physical charms than to a miscreant come forth from a toxic womb, malformed and insane at birth, to whom value and pleasure are to be found only in hatred.
Janice, I can't give you a control mechanism for the girl. It's not what the script calls for.
Tears well in those eyes that previously have been as dry as cinders. She doesn't shed them, but the tears shimmer and glimmer. She puts one hand to his face, tenderly pressing it against his right cheek. Leaning even closer, she whispers,
If you can't do this for me, then could you instead think of Lori the next time you need to let off some steam?
Genuinely bewildered, he says, Let off some steam?
You've never shown an interest in me, but I've always been so intensely drawn to you. My desire is unrequited, and I've resigned myself to that, but next time things go so wrong you need to relieve the tension, instead of wasting some drunken cowboy with a Texas True bumper sticker, think of that snarky little bitch Lori.
This twist in the script leaves him speechless. The unknown playwright's wicked imagination has at last thwarted Egon's usually reliable intuition. He never saw this coming. Assuming that his silence means he fears her disapproval, Janice slides her fingers along his cheek to his mouth and presses them to his lips.
No need to explain yourself. And please don't think that I've declared my feelings in the hope that we might have something together. I'm resigned to your disinterest. But I've loved you from afar, and I'll continue to love you. You're so strong. You do what you want, take what you want, always with such certainty that you'll triumph. The cowboy could have had a gun, and the others, the ones I know about anyway. In each case, something could have gone very wrong, but you were fearless. I watched. I saw.
When she takes her fingers from his lips, he remains so amazed that he can't help saying, "No reason to fear them. None of them was real. Nothing is real.
They're all just plebs, plotters, rabble, two-legged cattle," she says, under the misconception that they are both talking about the unwashed masses who will eventually come under the rule of the Arcadians, unaware that he is expressing his philosophy of life, his radical nihilism.
"Do you have siblings, Egon?"
"No. There's no one but me. No one real."
"How fortunate. I had three older sisters. You hate children?"
"I don't allow myself such strong emotions. What's the point if nothing's real?"
"Well, I have enough hate for both of us. Think about it, Egon. You don't have to love me in return. But maybe someday, when you're stressed out and you need relief, maybe you can come back here and do this one thing for me, just out of the goodness of your heart."
She walks away from him and returns to the Lundgren's house. Egon gets behind the wheel of the Rhino GX. He drives out to the end of the private lane that serves Lundgren Stables, where Rupert and Vince are waiting for him in the Jeep Wrangler. They turn right onto the highway, east, toward distant Austin. The afternoon sky is vast and empty. The fields dwindle to every horizon, as if they have become the sole feature of a world that has been shorn of its mountains and drained of its seas. Egon Gottfrey wonders what the script requires of him aside from this trip to Killeen. His usually reliable intuition regarding the author's intent fails him for the moment. He has no feeling for whether he's supposed to kill Lori Lundgren or Janice Dern, or both. Mile by mile, indecision plagues him, and his tension grows.
Chapter 42. The green plaque on the gate announced Grandpa and Grandma's place. Behind the white picket fence, on the manicured lawn, three gnomes sat on tree stumps, two smoking pipes and one playing what might have been a lute. Three other gnomes danced in delight. The blades on the four-foot-high windmill turned in the mild breeze. There was an ornate birdbath, too, but no feathered bathers. Perhaps some avian instinct warned them not to dare it. The sign above the front door read, "Bless this house." Jane rang the bell. Judy White and Lois Jones, one and the same, yet neither, opened the door. 50-something, buxom, well-rounded, jet-black hair, egg-yolk yellow fingernail polish, blue toenails. She wore flip-flops, a too-tight leopard-patterned sweatsuit, seven diamond rings, numerous gold and diamond bracelets, and a necklace of matched sapphires. She took the cigarette from between her lips and let smoke drift out of her mouth rather than blow it, and then she said, "So, you look like something happened."
"Something did, but I'm here."
"You have three times usual money?"
Jane held up the paper bag that had contained her truck stop sandwiches.
"Come in, darling. Sit. I see if Pete have everything ready."
The house reeked of cigarette smoke that would have dropped little grandchildren like Malathian felled mosquitoes, had there been any grandchildren, which there weren't. The interior, darkish, with far too many heavy antique furniture and brocade draperies and Persian carpets, offered none of the kitsch that fancified the front yard and served as a disguise. The woman went to her husband's large workroom at the back of the house, leaving Jane alone with the two white cats as big as bobcats. One was lying on a sofa, the other on a lazy boy recliner. They watched her as if she were prey. Jane moved toward a leather armchair, but the yellow-eyed cat leaped off the sofa and sprang onto that seat before she could occupy it. As she turned toward the now empty sofa, the green-eyed cat abandoned the recliner and took the first cat's original perch. When Jane looked at the lazy boy, both cats hissed. She said, "I'll just stand," which stopped the hissing. At the back of the rambling house, where visitors were rarely wanted, Pete Jones,
who was also John White and perhaps numerous other people, worked with several antique presses, laser printers, laminating machines, and so much other more exotic equipment that the place had a Frankenstein air. Instead of reanimating the dead, however, he produced impeccably forged documents of all kinds. The vision in leopard sweats reappeared in the archway between the living room and dining room, carrying something like a dress box that contained Jane's order.
I put on table.
You look, darling. She set the box on the table and removed the lid. In the center of the dining room table stood a crystal ball on a silver plinth. Beside it lay a deck of tarot cards, fanned out and ready for shuffling. Jane examined everything in the box. Very good. Very nice. My compliments to Pete.
Better than nice.
Yes, you're right. It's all excellent. The woman accepted the sandwich bag and took from it the two bricks of $100 bills held by rubber bands. She riffled the edges of the bills across her thumb, twice with each brick, cocking her head toward the sound.
No need count. You always honest, she said,
though she had probably done an accurate count with her devilishly sensitive thumb and hearing. It's so nice to be trusted, Jane said.
You want to know?
Know what? Judy Lois White Jones nodded her head at the crystal ball and the cards. Her smile was humorless, feline. Her eyes were as black and her stare as viscid as pools of tar. Jane said, I don't believe in all that.
Don't have to believe to be true. We'll be rich, we'll be poor, we'll be happy, we'll be sad, we'll live, we'll die. Just have to ask.
At the front door, as she stepped outside, Jane turned and met the woman's eyes. I make my own future. So do you.
But what is future? Crystal and cards could tell.
Have a nice day, Mrs. White Jones. I know I will.
Maybe. Maybe not, the woman said,
and closed the door. Chapter 43. The Jeep Wrangler and the Rhino GX are making good time until, north of Austin and south of Georgetown, they come upon an 18-wheeler that, minutes earlier, jackknifed on Interstate 35. The thin-skinned cargo trailer has split open, spilling a load of colorful athletic shoes designed by the nation's current number one rap star. Maybe 100 large cartons have tumbled onto the roadway, and most of these have burst open, casting forth uncountable shoeboxes emblazoned with the rapper's face, and in turn, the lids have flown off these smaller containers. A day-glow rainbow of expensive footwear is drifted across what little of the roadway the overturned vehicle itself does not block, and, in fact, the sudden avalanche of high-priced gotta-have sneakers seems to have overwhelmed a less-than-substantial Mini Cooper, smashing it into the guardrail. Two Texas Highway Patrol officers have recently arrived on scene, and beyond the barricade of truck and shoes, a southbound ambulance is flashing its way along the shoulder of the road. Traffic backs up so quickly in Egon Gottfried's wake that before he quite knows what has happened, he's locked in, bumper to bumper, with the vehicles behind and in front of him. He sits for a minute, wondering what the unknown playwright expects of him. Then he gets out of the Rhino to assess whether he might be able to maneuver out of his lane onto the shoulder of the highway and then reverse southward to the nearest exit. Just then, a third highway patrol officer comes along, putting down flares along the outer edge of the lane to keep the shoulder open for emergency vehicles inbound from the south. Godfrey halts the trooper, presents his bureau ID, and says, "You'll have to help us here. I and my men in that Jeep Wrangler urgently need to get past this mess." The trooper is maybe 6'4", built like a pro wrestler. He stares down at Godfrey in silence for a moment, frowning as though he has been addressed in a language known only by people on another planet. Then he says,
"Sir, in these circumstances, your DC badge means about as much to me as your library card. We got people hurt and a road to open."
As the officer turns away, Godfrey says, "I want your full name and badge number. There will be grave consequences if we don't get to Killeen within an hour." The trooper seems to swell 2 inches taller as he turns on Godfrey.
Sir, with all due respect, if you've just got to be in Killeen inside an hour, may I suggest you best stick a propeller in your ass and fart your way there?
Godfrey does not know what to say to that, and perhaps wisely he chooses to say nothing. After going forward 3 vehicles to the Jeep Wrangler and conferring with Rupert, he walks back to the Rhino and gets behind the wheel. He turns on the engine and powers down the windows and switches off the engine and tells himself that this delay doesn't matter. None of this has any meaning anyway. The overturned truck is not real. The shoes are not real. The rude highway patrol officer is not real. Killeen is not real. Godfrey is only along for the ride. The delay means nothing to him. So, it's curious, then, that he has the urge to get out of the Rhino and draw his pistol and shoot the trooper in the back. He is reasonably sure, however, that if he did such a thing, he would be going off script to such an extent that he would inevitably be punished for misinterpreting the playwright's work. As Egon Godfrey strives to be only a disembodied mind with no stake in these events, other drivers and their passengers in some of the surrounding vehicles realize the nature of the treasure that has spilled out of the overturned Peterbilt. Doors are flung open and people spring out. They dash forward into the heaps of ruptured cardboard containers, snatching up $300, $400, and $500 Dayglow sneakers, some still in their boxes, others loose and surely mismatched as to size. In a kind of ecstasy, they hurry back to their cars and SUVs with armfuls of celebrity footwear, only to return to the melee for more, while those people who remain in their vehicles look on with shocked and fearful expressions, as if they find themselves trapped in a traffic jam during a zombie apocalypse. The shoe shoppers are not real. The sneakers are not real. It all has no meaning. Egon Godfrey is only along for the ride. But when he thinks of Killeen, where perhaps Ansel and Claire can yet be found, he looks at the collapsible baton lying on the passenger seat, and he remembers the drunken cowboy outside Nashville West, and he is overcome with the urge to use that effective weapon on a few of these greedy shoe collectors, an urge that must be resisted. Chapter 44. Palm Springs. The Santa Rosa and San Jacinto Mountains, stark and mostly barren, plunging dramatically to the idyllic valley floor, palm trees stirring gently in the warm currents of the day, glittering shops and restaurants lining Palm Canyon Drive, all sun-splashed and palm-shaded, with an air of unhurried living. Places like this, built with tradition as much as with wood, stone, nails, and mortar, had once made Jane feel safe. Places where the storied past flowed through the present, where a way of life was largely preserved, evolving, but slowly and with grace. These days, perhaps such impressions were illusions. Maybe no place could long sustain against whatever new theory and collective madness was championed by the lords of the electronic and social media that saturated life. As their highest principle, those shapers of the future believed that the past was in all ways unspeakably primitive, that all change was for the better. A block back from Palm Canyon Drive, she found a modest motel charging immodest prices even on a weekday in April when the in-season rates slowly began to phase toward the off.